On this edition, we're inside the music with Grammy Award-winning artist Janice Ian. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation and music begins now. Janice Ian was catapulted into the spotlight in 1966 at age 15, when her soul-wrenching song about an interracial relationship, Society's Child, became a hit. The song climbed the charts despite the fact that many radio stations across the country refused to play it because of its controversial subject matter. But this was only the beginning of a long and illustrious career. In 1975, Ian's legendary At 17 earned 2 Grammy Awards and 5 nominations. Her next 2 albums brought her worldwide platinum hits. But after 7 albums in as many years, she made a conscious decision to walk away from the music business and devote herself to writing. During this period, she struggled through a difficult marriage that ended with her then-husband's attempts to destroy her and a sudden illness that very nearly cost her life. The hiatus from music lasted for close to a decade until in 1993, Ian returned with the release of the Grammy-nominated Breaking Silence, and she's been making unforgettable music ever since. It's a joy to have her on today's program, and she joins us from her home in Nashville, Tennessee. Janice Ian, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Hey, I gotta ask, you're in a short break on your spring tour with the amazing Tom Paxton. How's the tour going so far?
Oh, it's fantastic, Richard. It's really great. I was just talking with a friend about how easy it is to lose your edge as you get older and just run out of as much energy as you have when you're 20.
Oh, yeah.
But this kind of tour really just brings it all back. You know, we're on stage together for all but 4 songs. So that's 90% of the show. We sing each other's songs. We play on each other's songs. We've got Robin Bullock to add a third voice, so we get to do 3-part harmony. It's about as close to a band as I'm going to get.
How did this idea come to fruition, you and Tom coming together this year?
I had a thought about 5 years ago that it would be fun to go out with someone else who I respected and admired, who wrote singable songs. I had a whole list of criteria, who had known me a long time, and Tom has known me since I was 13 years old.
That's what I thought.
So I called Tom and I said, I have this idea for a show that's actually a show, not a I'll sing half a set and then you sing half a set, but that would actually take some rehearsal time. And Tommy was funny. He said, oh, I don't know. I don't really rehearse with other people that much. And I said, come on, Tom, give me 3 days. And so we took the 3 days, and at the end, we were both thrilled. Took it to the UK last year with Robin and just solidified everything, added a couple of new songs. And it's real bang for the buck for the audience, I think, because they get to hear things they wouldn't ordinarily hear, like Tom does a tearjerker version of my song Through the Years, and I get to sing Last Thing on My Mind. They get to watch 2 colleagues, in the best sense of the word, share a stage instead of letting ego get in the way, appreciating each other's work. But they also get me singing At 17 and Society's Child and the solo songs that they've come to expect from both of us.
Yeah, you were
nice.
You were just at a beautiful venue. I've been there up in Chicago. Sold out. You've had a lot of sold out events so far.
And, Old Town School. Great venue.
Yeah, and when you go back on tour, for those who are listening across the country to this show, you're going to be heading to 2 warm spots, Florida and California.
Yeah, we somehow booked this backwards. We started off in the Northeast in March, and then Chicago and Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And then in April and May, we wound up in Florida and the West Coast. So something very wrong. But Tom is retiring at the end of this year. He is getting off the road.
Okay.
But for the occasional big concert festival thing, he's not going to do the kind of touring that he's always done. So when he announced that last year, I said, let me scramble, let's find some dates, because I really want another crack. And we actually taped both shows in Chicago, and we videotaped, so hopefully we'll get something out of that.
Yeah, and for our listeners, for more information, to find out where Janice and Tom are going to be performing, perhaps in your city, you can go to janiceian.com, the website. Janice, I have been such a fan of yours for years. We have a lot to cover in a short amount of time, so I'm just going to dive right in. First of all, for those, and I'm assuming we're talking a younger crowd who might be listening, who don't know as much about you, you started in music at a very, very young age. You were a prodigy.
Well, I guess. I don't really know. To me, Mozart was a prodigy. I was just very active. Uh-huh. I started writing songs when I was 12 and made my first record, Society's Child, when I was 14.
Yeah.
At, I guess, I don't know, what's my curriculum vitae? I've got 9 Grammy nominations in 8 categories. Most recent Grammy was 2 years ago for my autobiography narrating.
Yeah, and you beat out quite an impressive list of people, too.
I did, including the First Lady and former President Clinton. Yes, it was quite impressive. I was pretty stunned. I'm still stunned every time I walk past it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were all sitting there going, who the hell was that?
On this show, we profile what we call social change artists and the spirit of their message. I just had Holly Neer on a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you're on her list of top social change artists. And what I didn't know in doing research about you, you grew up really in that environment because your dad was under surveillance by the FBI back in the day.
My dad and my mom, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole family. It was kind of, my kid brother escaped it, but the rest of us were caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father was a farmer, and he went to a meeting about the price of eggs, literally, and the FBI picked him up on his way home and wanted to know how many communists were in the meeting, and my poor dad said, hey, you know, we're a bunch of farmers. We're trying to set the price of eggs in this area. Come on.
For crying out loud.
But they, yeah. And then my mom went to the Civil Rights Congress. And so they started tracking her.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I had a hit with Society's Child, so I was on the list.
Yeah.
You know, it's a terrible thing to remember those years, and yet they are being so forgotten. And I think amidst the demagoguery of our present politicians and the attitude of a lot of people, which seems to be us and them, and most of us are them, we do well to remember those HUAC years when careers like my father's were destroyed and people who were writing in Hollywood had to write under false names and hide. It was hundreds of thousands of people's lives were destroyed or altered because of it. And it's a terrible thing to see happening in a country like America.
I can't imagine at a very young age, at 12, your first song was Hair of Spun Gold, but it was the breakout hit Society's Child. You wrote that at 13. But I just want to quote something. It came out of your prologue in your book. It's a beautifully written book. And by the way, I've been reading your book. I've been listening to your music. You have such a story. When is the film coming out, Janice?
Yeah. Fortunately, there's no interest in a film.
You're kidding. You are kidding me.
I'm not sure that would be so great. I don't know. I have heard that Tina Turner really regretted it.
Oh,
and
okay.
I could see that.
Well, I want to take...
I don't know. There's just so much of being called legendary that you can take before you go, wait till I'm dead, please.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me just read a little bit out of the prologue. I want you to respond, and I think we'll go right into the song. But you said, you're standing alone on a stage in Encino, California, halfway through the first verse of my song, Society's Child. Come to my door, baby. Face it clean and shining black as night. My mama went to answer, you know that you look so fine now. I could understand the tears and the shame. She called you boy instead of your name. And then you went on and wrote, the problem had begun with a lone woman screaming out the words, nigger lover. Then the people sitting around her joined in, chanting as though they were in a religious service. They were even chanting in time to the song. Nigger lover, nigger lover, beat, 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 nigger lover, nigger lover. It was difficult to concentrate on keeping my own time. The chant disintegrated into yelling. 20 or 30 people in a sold-out concert hall. I peered to the left, where the sound came from, and saw some of them beginning to rise. They were shaking their fists in the air as the rest of the audience looked on in stunned silence. I was having a hit record. I was singing for people who wanted me dead. I was 15 years old. What was that?
Very dramatic, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah. I can't imagine going through that, let alone at such a young age.
Well, I think it's like any kind of traumatic event. When you're young, especially, you get through it. You go through and you ignore it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in all humility. That was a horrifying experience, there's no doubt, and it chased me for decades. And I was afraid of my audiences for decades because I had had so many death threats. But the flip side of that is when I look at what's going on in places like the Middle East, the Ukraine, where my grandmother came from,
yes,
and what those people are living with day to day, fists and threats are, don't seem very bad compared to bullets, really.
Yeah,
I think there's a level where you have to have some perspective, and it is one of the great things that age gives you.
We hopefully do get wisdom as we get older, don't we?
Well, or at least we get beat up enough that we're too tired to fight.
Yeah. Are you? Let me ask you this question, and we'll go to the song. Given what you went through, what you experienced, also what we all experienced as a country in the 60s and even the 70s, and then we see, I think, racism coming out of the closet in a more bold way once we elected our first black president. And now you and I and others see things on the news that are breaking out in various cities. Are you encouraged or discouraged about how we are treating one another in this country?
Well, I think that the world, or at least my little corner of it, has changed remarkably for the better. That may be Pollyanna-ish, but I try to remember that if we were living 200 years ago, we wouldn't have heard most of this news.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a gay person, as a Jew, as a woman, it's certainly improved from what it was when I was born, or when my mother was born, or when I was growing up. I mean, I can't be incarcerated for being gay. I can't be forced into a lobotomy. I can even get married most places now. As a Jew, I can't be denied admittance to a school, not overtly anyway. As a woman, I've got a lot of rights I didn't have before and a lot of protection. I'm not going to say it's enough. I loved the Ruth Bader Ginsburg quote when someone asked her how many women she thought on the Supreme Court would be enough, and she said nine. And they said, well, that's crazy. And she said, well, nobody thinks it's crazy that nine men were there. So, you know, we've still got a ways to go with each other, but I hope that as each generation is born into going to school with people of different colors and cultures, for instance, it's really hard to hate people you know.
Exactly.
You have to dehumanize people to hate them.
Exactly. And so light workers, you, so many others, we need to keep putting the music out there. We need to keep putting our light out there. What's making the national news now is our Indiana governor's getting ready to sign, I believe today, a religious freedom bill that will actually be a bill about discrimination.
Yeah, don't you think if you're allowed to discriminate, you should have to pay taxes to do that?
Yes, I do. I do. I do. I love Society's Child. It was a groundbreaking song. It was inducted eventually into the Grammy Hall of Fame. I want to go to that song right now. It's one of my favorite Janis songs. So we're inside the music today with Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, and author Janis Ian. And now here's her classic song, Society's Child.
Come to my door, baby. Faces clean and shining black as night. My mother went to answer, you know that you look so fine. Now I could understand your tears and your shame. She called you boy instead of your name. When she wouldn't let you inside. When she turned and said, but honey, they turn and say, why don't you stick to your own kind? My teachers all laughed at smirking stares, cutting deep down in our affairs. Preachers of equality think they believe it, then why won't they just let us be? They say, I can't see you anymore. guess I'm gonna stop my listening, gonna raise my head up high. One of these days I'm gonna raise up my glistening wings and fly. But that day will have to wait for a while. Baby, I'm only society's child. When we're older, things may change, but for now, this is the way they must remain. I say I can't see you anymore, baby. I can't see you anymore, no. I don't want to see you anymore, baby.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. We're inside the music with Janice E., and it's such a joy and honor to have her on the program. You've been, Janice, quite the trailblazer for a lot of other artists, and there's a chapter in your book. The book is your autobiography called Society's Child, and this chapter's about stars. And before I get into a segment in there, talk about what it was like when you first were thought of as a one-hit wonder, Society's Child. You then came out in that great year, I believe it was 74 with its 17. We'll talk more about that. But there was a time in your life, though. There was ebb and flow in your work, wasn't there?
Well, I think there always is for any artist.
Uh-huh.
Somebody once said to me, no matter how big you are, you're still worried about it. I mean, Michael Jackson died worried that he would never hold the ultimate record in sales.
Yeah.
You know, and look where he was.
Mm-hmm.
Elton John worries about that. I mean, people much bigger than me
mm-hmm.
worry about those things. So I try not to think about it, you know? I just try to do the best work that I can possibly do and not settle.
Yeah.
That's about it.
You were such and are now, probably more than ever, such a gifted songwriter. But I believe there was a time in your career when you were beginning to question that. You were lacking some confidence in that.
Well, I started out writing blind, as we
mm-hmm.
say,
mm-hmm.
meaning I didn't know what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know why. Sometimes I would turn out a really good song, like Society's Child, but most of the time I would turn out real crap, and I didn't have any sort of consistency.
Yeah.
And I think that continued well into my 30s until I moved to Los Angeles and started studying acting with Stella Adler, and things began falling into place when she would talk about art and artists and what they went through, other artists, like Tennessee Williams. And then I moved to Nashville, and Nashville is a town of songwriters, and I really thank Nashville every chance I get because they welcomed me at a time when nobody else particularly wanted me.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, the songwriters were not afraid to say to me, I don't think that works. I don't know why you're putting that there, or to argue.
Yeah.
I mean, the philosophy here is it's just like math. A plus and a minus make a minus. So when it's right, everybody in the room knows it.
Mm-hmm.
When it's wrong, only one person may know it, but you have to respect it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How does that process work for you? It's always different with each artist, but because I do think your lyrics are so powerful, do they just come and you realize you got another song, or where's the inspiration?
It usually starts that way. It starts with, for me, it starts with a line or a rhythm
mm-hmm.
or a guitar pattern or a melody. Gosh, it just depends on the song. I mean, F-17 started with, I was reading the New York Times, and there was an article by a woman who thought that everything would be solved when she became a debutante. And her opening line was, I learned the truth at 18. And then I was playing guitar at the time, and it 17 scammed with what I was playing. So
yeah.
It started with that. The song John Mellencamp recorded, To the River, the opening line is, I am master and slave. I was watching a film, I think by the BBC, with Glenda Jackson in it, and it was based on Jean Genet play, The Maids, and at one point Jackson said, I am master and slave.
Mm.
And I thought, ooh, that's good. You know, it's the marvelous, mysterious, incredible thing about being born with talent,
mm-hmm.
and I can't take any credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there, and if you leave the door open, as Stella said, your talent knows better than you do, so listen.
Yeah. You listened intently one night. You talk about this later on. I believe the chapter is called Stars. And by the way, what a beautiful song that is.
Thank you.
Not as well known.
One of my favorite songs.
Yeah, but you were inspired by a Don McLean song, Vincent.
And I was.
Yeah, you said, I was listening with half an ear when a song called Vincent came on. It drew me in, and before I knew it, I was fully involved. What was it about that song in that moment in your life?
Oh, my God, it's a great song. It's a perfect song. How many perfect songs do you hear in a lifetime, much less get to write?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, perfect songs run the gamut from To Do Ron Ron, which I consider a perfect pop song, to Vincent, which is a classic. Don did everything right. Melody, words, both impeccable, arrangement impeccable, singing impeccable, everything is right. There's no more than you need and no less than you have to have.
Hmm.
And at that moment, that was exactly what I had been striving for, to write with that kind of honesty and that kind of truth and that kind of elegance is the only word for it, that kind of elegance. And I started writing Stars after listening to that record a billion times, and I finished it the next morning. And I thought, nobody's ever going to listen to an 8 or 9 minute song, and yet it remains my most covered song.
Yeah. It's a beautiful song. The lyrics are amazing. And it seemed like after hearing that song and just really embracing it in your heart and in your soul, the words from Stars just started to come to you.
Yeah, it was one of those rare times, Richard. They say in Nashville that you got to keep the motor oiled by writing a lot, because even though most of what you write won't be usable, when the inspiration really hits, you'll be ready for it. And I had been doing an exercise of writing a song a day for about 6 months, and then every other day, and then every week. And then I had said, okay, now I'm done, I'll see what comes. And I was ready.
Yeah.
I was just ready to write the song. And I think that the reason other people have recorded it so much, I mean, everybody, gosh, an amazing list. Mel Torme and Cher and Glenn Campbell and Charles Aznavour, and it's a great list. But I think the reason is because it speaks to the truth of being an artist without a lot of self-pity.
I'm Richard Brendan. We're inside the music today with award-winning artist Janice Ian. We're going to go to one of her songs now called Stars. And if you'd like more information on Janice and also listen to a lot of her music, you can go to her website, janiceian.com. Let's go to the song right now. We'll come back on the other side.
I was never one for singing what I really feel. Except tonight I'm bringing everything I know that's real. Or slow, they go like the last light of the sun, all in a blaze. And all you see is glory. Hey, but it gets lonely there when there's no one here to share. We can shake it away. Swinging, some of us are downed, some of us are crowned, and some are lost and never found, but most have seen it all. They live their lives in sad cafes and music halls. They always come up singing. Some make it when they're young, before
the world has done its dirty job. And later on, someone will say you've had your day. Now you must make way. But they'll never know the pain of living with a name you never owned, or the many years forgetting what you know too well. That the ones who gave the crown have been let down. You try to make amends without defending, perhaps pretending you never saw the eyes of grown men of 25 that follow as you walk and ask for autographs or kiss you on the cheek. And you never can believe they really loved you. Some make it when they're old. Perhaps they have a soul they're not afraid to bear. Or perhaps there's nothing there. They come slow, they go like the last light of the sun, all in a blaze. And all you see is glory. But most have seen it all. They live their lives in sad cafes and music halls. They have a story. Some women have a body men will want to see, and so they put it on display. Some people play a fine guitar. I could listen to them play all day. Some ladies really move across the stage, and she, they shook and danced. I guess I could learn how, if I gave it half a chance. But I always feel so funny when my body tries to soar, and I seem to always worry about missing the next chord. Guess there isn't anything to put up on display except the tune and whatever else I say. But anyway, that isn't really what I meant to say. Story. I live from day to day. Stars, they come and go. They come in fast, they come slow, and they go like the last light of the sun, all in a blaze. And all you see is glory. Most have seen it all, live their lives in sad cafes and music halls, and we always have a story. So if you don't lose patience with my fumbling around, I'll come up singing for you.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. We're inside the music today with Grammy Award-winning artist Janice Ian. Janice, you've also been blessed with a lot of people who have been like angels to you. They've helped you when you needed it most, such as Leonard Bernstein, when your first groundbreaking hit came up, Society's Child, and he invited you on his show. With 17, you were the first performer on Saturday Night Live.
Well, that was... The song was already being a hit, but I was certainly being helped by Sony and by Herb Gart and by my manager at the time, Gene Powell, and my attorney. I had a good group around me. I've been fortunate that good people have enjoyed my work and supported it.
Yeah.
And that continues to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very lucky in that respect. But I also think that I'm a big believer in things happen as they're meant to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stop trying to push on the river too hard, it won't swallow you up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So once in a while I sit back and I go, Janice, take a deep breath and just leave it go and see what happens. that doesn't mean that you don't have to be actively involved.
Right.
But it does mean that you can cut yourself some slack and not have to control the universe.
Mm. When you wrote the song at 17, you write in your book that you said, I think I just wrote a hit single. You knew.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the rare times in my life when I actually knew what I was doing. I knew.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that if it had a chance, and I actually ended up throwing my then manager out of the studio because she kept telling me I was destroying the single, and I kept saying, shut up, I know what I'm doing, leave me alone.
What was it about that song that struck a chord with so many people to make it so popular to this day?
I think it hits the universal. You know, that's what we all strive for,
mm-hmm.
people like Tom and myself and Robin, too. We try to hit the universal, and it's a rare and an amazingly powerful thing when you do, because it's just not something you are fortunate enough to run across that often in your life as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do manage to hit it and embrace it, and then you're fortunate enough to, as in that case, have the right record company, the right management team, the right time for the song, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of it is that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're fortunate enough to have all of that going for you, sometimes it becomes a truly marvelous thing, and you wind up with an at 17 that, to my astonishment, is still heavily played today and heavily used today.
Yeah, yeah. And is also in the Grammy Hall of Fame.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm, very cool. There was, a touching story, actually, because I love his music. When you were touring and opening up for, actually, it was Loggins and Messina at the time, but Kenny Loggins, and he really spoke up for you about steak.
Mm-hmm.
And having enough mm-hmm. steak for an opening artist such as yourself.
Yeah, those boys are very good to me. They never forgot what it was like to be the opener.
Yeah, yeah, I bet it was. You've had a lot of people that you've worked with along the way. Do you have any favorites as you look back on your career?
I wouldn't even go there. I mean, you know, except for the obvious, I wouldn't be spending 2 months on tour with somebody I didn't like a lot. I mean, I love Tom Paxton,
mm-hmm.
Arlo Guthrie. I love Arlo.
Mm-hmm.
People who were good to me as a child, Dave Van Ronk, Odetta. Sadly, a number of them have passed away.
Yeah.
Nina Simone was very good to me in her more coherent moments. Other artists in general have been very kind to me
mm-hmm.
and very respectful of my work. But you know, in general, I like artists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're a difficult bunch, and we're an awkward bunch, but there are only one or two artists in the world that I say, no, I won't get on stage with that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty rare.
Yeah. The song at 17, it won the 1975 Grammy Award for Best Pop Vocal Performance. My goodness, once again, you were competing against amazing competition. Linda
yeah.
Ronstadt, Olivia Newton-John, Helen Reddy. Were you shocked and surprised when you won? They called your name?
I was surprised that I won for female vocalist
uh-huh.
and not for song.
Yeah,
I thought 17 was a really good song.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I was surprised to win as a vocalist because I didn't think of myself as a singer that as much as I do now.
Mm.
Now when I listen back to the track, I can hear Billie Holiday in it, and I can hear Edith Piaf, and I can hear all my other influences. But then It was just a means to get the song down.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Linda was, you know, the people like Linda and Olivia were just so kind to me after, and they really taught me how to behave when you lost,
mm-hmm.
which was a great, which stood me in great stead for the six that I've lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My guest today is Janice Ian, Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, author, even a columnist. I'm Richard Brendan. We're inside the music. We're going to go to now one of her greatest hits at 17, and we'll continue on with the conversation.
I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens. In high school, girls with clear-skinned smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems, it's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, they only get what they deserve. In the rich relation, hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of come.
My guest is Janice Ian. Janice, you have a foundation that's named after your mother called the Pearl Foundation.
I do.
Can you share a little bit about that, please?
We formed the Pearl Foundation when my mother died in 1998,
mm-hmm.
and we kicked off with what is now historically the first internet auction. We put 300-plus items up for sale. You can still see it on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And we raised $63,000 for the school she attended. My mother had multiple sclerosis, and the last 14 years of her life that she was capable of working, she couldn't work a regular job. Mm. She was on disability. She had always dreamed of going to college, and I sent her to college. It took her 14 years to get her degree, but she did get it, and I'm convinced it kept her alive longer.
Mm-hmm.
So when she died, it seemed the best way to honor her would be to provide college scholarships. And Pat, my wife, and I couldn't afford to do that. So we started the Pearl Foundation on Wings and a Prayer. And to date, we've given away more than $810,000, and we've seen, I believe it's 24 people graduate now. We've got scholarships running at four different schools or five.
Mm-hmm.
And our operating costs annually have never exceeded $1,500. So we are really proud of it. And people who go to my website and listen to free downloads, or you can listen to pretty much everything I've ever recorded on the website,
mm-hmm.
or get free lyrics, get free transcriptions, we encourage them to just send a dollar. And those dollars add up. We have people who tithe every month, and there's a tip jar at the shows. People put in their change sometimes, or, gosh, last week we got a check for $5,000 from someone.
Ah, beautiful.
I was so glad I checked.
I bet you were.
But at the end of the year, we distribute the money to the schools we're working with.
That's great.
And they, in turn, provide scholarships for older students who might not be fresh out of college or fresh out of high school and might not be as eligible for sexy scholarships as some.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Pat. How long have you been together now?
We are on year 26, which is really astonishing to both of us.
That is beautiful. And you were married in Canada, I believe, because you could get married at that time.
We were. We were married in Canada in 2003. We had been, I think, the second couple to register for domestic partnership when that became legal in Provincetown.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Canada because we thought, well, it's probably a good idea and we should show our support. We have no idea that it would ever be legal in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty great thing.
So whether it be romantic love or a love for our brother and sister, what have you and are you learning about love these days, Janice?
It's a compromise.
I mean, it is, isn't it?
Marriage is. It's a compromise. Very time-consuming. A lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And very worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. You end your autobiography, Society's Child, with a chapter called Joy. It's also the title of a song that we'll be closing with. And you write, In general, I think God knows what he's doing, even though I often disagree. And as much as I try to control the universe, it rolls over me without a qualm, often leaving pain and confusion in its wake. But the older I get, the more I realize that everything happens for a reason.
I firmly believe that. Yep.
There's that wisdom again with age and experience, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if it's wisdom so much as fatigue, really.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, Janice Ian, it's been a joy to have you on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
It was an honor to have Janice Ian on the program. And again, her website is janiceian.com. And now we're going to go to another song off of Janice's, actually the best of Janice Ian, the autobiography collection. This song is called Joy.
I wish your roses in the spring, fledglings on the wing, fireflies that sing your name. I wish your flowers in the grass, memories that last, shelter from the passing. I wish you joy. I wish you joy. I wish you joy. I hope the wind is at your back, keeping you on track, that you never lack for love. I hope you walk beside your heart, even in the dark, guided by the stars above. I wish you love. wish you love. I wish you love. So wherever you may roam, out there on your own, home is just a heart away. I wish you joy. I wish you joy. I wish you joy.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. We're Inside the Music with Janice Ian. It was a joy to have her on the program, and what a beautiful song that was. If you'd like to get a sample of all of her albums that she's produced, you can do that on her website. It's a very interactive website with a lot of valuable information. And again, that's janiceian.com. In closing, I want to share a section out of the prologue of Janice Ian's autobiography, Society's Child. She writes, "Shortly before cutting Society's Child, when I was still 14, I'd run into Ellie Greenwich up at Shadow's office. I was tongue-tied. I loved her songwriting, thought Da Do Ron Ron was brilliant, and couldn't think of a thing to say. Shadow rescued me, telling her I was also a songwriter and performer. And with a stern look, she turned to me and said, 'Kid, this business is about hard work, and don't you ever forget it. It's about getting your period, having cramps that are killing you, then walking on stage to do the show anyhow, and never letting the crowd know it. If you don't have the guts for that, don't even start.' Yep, that was my lineage now, like it or not. I wiped my eyes with a paper towel, then looked down at the floor, hoping I wouldn't start crying again. The promoter awkwardly patted my shoulder and said, 'Well?' Well, I lifted my head to meet his eyes, then took a deep breath. 'Well, if I die tonight, you know, if something goes wrong, just tell my folks and my brother I love them.' It seemed like the brave thing to say, even though what I really wanted to tell him was, 'I'm not a coward. I'm just scared. And I want to go home right now and hide under the bed.' He walked me to the wings. The house lights had been turned up to half while the crew waited to find out what came next. The lights went out, and a spotlight drifted toward the side of the stage where I stood, taking deep breaths and blanking my mind everything but the show. I squared my shoulders and walked back to center stage, picked up my guitar, adjusted the microphone, and began singing Society's Child again from the top. At first, there were a few more shouts, but I ignored them and kept going. I closed my eyes to help myself concentrate, tuning out the noise, tuning in to the words and the music. And oddly enough, as I continued to ignore the shouting, the audience members took matters into their own hands. A few rose and walked over to the troublemakers, telling them to shut up. An usher came down the aisle and shone his flashlight in their faces, threatening to eject them bodily if they continued. And slowly, the crowd of people who'd been disrupting things began leaving the theater. As they rose and filed into the aisles, I stopped singing, but I kept playing the guitar chords, tapping my foot to the beat. My eyes were wide open and my head was high as I watched them go. I wanted to let them know I was no longer afraid. And when the theater doors closed behind the last of them, I began the final verse. One of these days, I'm going to stop my listening, going to raise my head high. One of these days, I'm going to raise up my glistening wings and fly. As I got to the words, "I'm going to raise my glistening wings and fly," there was a roar from the crowd, and the entire room stood up, and someone began clapping. The rest of the room joined in, and I grinned like a fool as I strummed the final chords. I had a standing ovation even before I finished the song.
My chaperone and I left the theater quietly, me hiding on the floor of the back seat to avoid the picket line and any further disruptions. It had been funny earlier in the day, rolling up to the theater and seeing signs with "Nigger Lover Go Home" and "No Race Mixing Allowed Here," but it wasn't so funny now. I never ate before a show, and I'd spent a lot more energy than usual as we stopped at a roadside coffee shop about half an hour out of town for a quick bite. This was farm country, and the counter was full of seated men wearing hard-worn jeans and neatly buttoned shirts, the dust of the fields still on their soles. In my bright hippie clothing, dangling earrings and beads, I attracted a fair amount of attention any time I left a major city. Usually, there wasn't big trouble, just a few snide remarks like, "Is that a girl or a boy?" or "Who let the animals out of the zoo?" But I'd just been through an awful experience, and I tensed as they turned to look at me. The waitress grinned as we ordered, trying not to laugh. I must have looked like something she'd seen on television or in magazines with articles on the new generation. After she took our orders, the place settled down, but I noticed one older man staring at me out of the corner of his eye. Now, in my 50s, I realized he wasn't so very old at all, but back then, he seemed ancient. Maybe he saw me on TV, and he's just staring because he's never seen a famous person this close before. I tried to tell myself that, but alarm bells were going off in my head. He kept gawking, and it became irritating. It's hard to relax when someone actually turns around on their corner stool and stares at you without pretense, occasionally whispering something to the person next to them and laughing. I felt like a zoo animal. By now our food had arrived, but mine tasted like sawdust. It seemed like the entire diner was lining up against me, and I braced myself for the worst. I wondered if he'd come over and spit in my plate, or just take me out back and lynch me, then bury me in a cornfield somewhere. I just bet he was one of that group calling me a nigger lover. I clenched my jaw. Dinner was ruined. The entire day was ruined. The more I thought about it, picking at my food, the madder I got. Scared as I was also getting really angry. And as I pushed the plate away, he rose and started to walk toward us. Uh-oh. Here it comes. I could feel my muscles tightening. My chaperone, blissfully unaware, kept her eyes on her cheeseburger and her mouth wrapped around the fries. I felt totally alone. He came to our table, paused, stuck his hands in his pockets, and said, "Hey." I looked up with no smile and said, "Hey, back at you." He smiled broadly, and suddenly he didn't look so old or so mean. "Just wanted to say, I was at your show tonight. Good job. Thanks." My confusion must have shown on my face. It took a minute for me to register that he was actually complimenting me, not hawking a gob of saliva onto my food. I could feel myself flushing with embarrassment. Thanks for the compliment. It was a rough show. I tried a tentative smile, but my face wasn't working right yet. "Yeah, it was rough, but you handled it. You showed him, but good. Nice job, kid." And with that, he turned and walked away. As we left the diner, my chaperone looked at me curiously and said, "What on earth was that about?" She had no idea. While I was dealing with the crowd, she'd been up in the office, dealing with the money. I shrugged and then said, "It's nothing. Just that sometimes you can't judge on first impressions." That reading is out of Janice Ian's award-winning book, Society's Child, My Autobiography. Janice's autobiography ends with a chapter called Joy, and that was a song we just heard. I thought we'd finish the show with a song about love. It's taken off of her album, The Best of Janice Ian, Today You're Mine.
No, you're not the first. Yes, I've had a past. Completely unrehearsed. A small supporting cast. drink too fast. Though I'm not your first, I intend to be the last. Suddenly there's something more than memories and time. Though I never knew the way before today, you're mine. I used to be afraid shadows in the air, and all your yesterdays really can't compare. But all these memories clinging to the past, they fade like the autumn leaves. You see, you're mine.
That's today's program. Our website is richardbrendon.com. For senior producer Lisa Morrison, engineer Joe Bainline, and production coordinator Kate Miller, I'm Richard Brendon. Join us next week as once again we go inside the music, celebrating social change artists and the spirit of their message.